WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wanda Jackson has been called the Queen of Rockabilly, but let's face it, there weren't a lot of women rockers who could have been in line for the crown. Jackson toured with Elvis Presley in the mid-50s, and it was the king himself who encouraged her to try to cross over from country to rock and roll. Her biggest rock and roll hit was a song that Elvis recorded first, Let's Have a Party. It was her only record to make it to the top 40. But she also had records on the country music chart, such as In the Middle of a Heartache and Right or Wrong. Now at the age of 65, Jackson has a new CD called Heart Trouble that features her singing with younger performers, including Elvis Costello, Dave Alvin, and Rosie Flores. She does some of the songs she's always performed, as well as more contemporary material. Before we hear music from Heart Trouble, let's go back to her 1958 recording, Let's Have a Party. That's Wanda Jackson's 1958 recording of Let's Have a Party. Wanda Jackson, welcome to Fresh Air. You've been called the queen of rockabilly. How did you start performing rockabilly music? I mean, you started off doing country music. How did you make the transition to rockabilly?
Well, you're right. I started in country music. And then in 1955, after I'd graduated from high school, the first touring that I did was with a young fellow early in his career, too, and it was Elvis Presley. And I worked with Elvis off and on for a couple of years, and I could see that this new style of music that he was doing, that, you know, I loved it. And I was with him right as he was really breaking big, you know. And he's the one that encouraged me to try. He said, I think you could sing this kind of music. And being just country, you know, I said, I don't think I could ever get the feel like you do. He said, sure you can. So he encouraged me. He took me to his home and played records, and then he'd sing for me and saying, if you kind of do it this way. And so, you know, I had a good teacher.
So one of the things Elvis was famous for, in addition to his singing style, was how he looked on stage. You know, he was very sexy, and he was very sexually suggestive on stage, particularly for the period. Did you pick up on that aspect as well? Did you change what you wore? Did you change what you did on stage?
Well, I had already changed my stage attire. You know, I didn't want to be in full skirts and cowboy boots and cowboy hat.
Why did you want to change the look?
I don't look good in those things. That was the main thing. I've never been able to wear a full skirt, haven't to this day. And the cowboy hats and those old clubby boots, you know, I just didn't like it. I didn't feel like that was me. Because I was a big fan of Marilyn Monroe and Elizabeth Taylor, and I wanted to look like them, you know. I used to go to all the musicals and with paper and pen, and when I'd see a dress I liked, I'd sketch it down real fast. And so we've copied one dress off of Betty Grable and one off of Marilyn, and it's kind of funny when I look back at the old pictures and say, oh, I remember where I found that type of dress. But my mother was a professional seamstress, and she did all of my costumes for me.
Now, what was it like for you to watch Elvis become this just phenomenon?
Well, it was exciting. I was excited for him. And, of course, like I said, I was 17 and 18 years old, so I was a fan of his as well as a friend, and I was thrilled to death. at his success, he was very concerned and disturbed all the time about the things being said to him about his gyrations and things like that, and it really upset him. It hurt him. He was a very sensitive guy, I think. Somewhere along there, about 56, he was getting so popular, they had to stop him from autographing or meeting with his fans, you know. And that really hurt him because he loved his fans and wanted to shake their hands or what have you. But, you know, they were already pulling his coat off and tie and things when I was working with him. And it just got worse. And they said, someone's going to get hurt if we don't stop you from this autographing. So I remember that.
Let's hear a song that you wrote that was a country hit for you. It's called Right or Wrong. And this was recorded in 1960. Did you think of this as more of a country song than a rockabilly?
Yes, I did. I wrote the song, and it was definitely, it really wasn't country, but in the 60s, country music was beginning to use the violin sections and singing groups behind us, you know, and so I was really just in the trend of what people like Patsy Cline and were doing, and Brenda Lee and things. So that song was one of the first that lent itself to that type of an arrangement.
Well, let's hear it. This is Wanda Jackson, recorded in 1960, Right or Wrong.
Right or wrong, I'll be with you. Right or wrong, right or wrong, it's gotta be. Always you, always me. Won't you take me along to be with you, right or wrong?
Wanda Jackson recorded in 1960 her song Right or Wrong. Now, you said before that you weren't really comfortable performing rock and roll to teenagers or rockabilly to teenagers because you were used to performing for adults and you just didn't relate to these teenagers. Did that affect your staying in country music as opposed to trying to cross over more into that teen rock and roll audience?
Yeah, probably so, Terry. If Right or Wrong, you know, right after Let's Have a Party, Right or Wrong became a hit. It was a crossover song, too, meaning it was high on the charts in country, but it was also in the rock and roll or the, I think then they called it pop and soul music. So it was in the charts. And that's when I tried to do these teenage things and just, you know, didn't really care for it at all. So, yeah, I've considered myself country really all through my career until we get to about 1985. And I was invited to Sweden to record a rockabilly album. And it was from that point on that I realized how popular I was with the new rockabilly fans, not only in Europe, all over Europe and Scandinavia, but also in America eventually.
So you found this more specialized audience who cared a lot about your records.
Mm-hmm. And that's what made it so exciting to see these young adults into this 50s rock music.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just been having the greatest time working with bands that they sound just like our bands used to, and they're really into the lifestyle, and they drive the classic cars, and they dress in vintage clothes.
Now, I want to play something from your new CD, which is called Wanda Jackson, Heart Trouble, and features several guest stars, including Elvis Costello, Dave Alvin, The Cramps. Let's hear a song called Funnel of Love, which also features The Cramps. Do you want to talk about this song and why it's on the CD?
Well, it was on the back of Right or Wrong, and so I didn't think it got much airplay, you know. But a couple of years ago, these new rockabilly fans started requesting Funnel of Love, and I couldn't imagine, so I had to go back and relearn it, and that's why I put it on this album. I thought I'd like for them to have a newer, kind of fresher version. I'm singing it the same, but the music is a little more up-to-date, and I wanted to do it.
Well, I'm glad you relearned it. I like the record. My guest is Wanda Jackson, who has been called the Queen of Rockabilly. Now at the age of 65, she has a new CD called Heart Trouble. There are several guest artists on the new CD, Dave Alvin, Elvis Costello, The Cramps. Did you know their work before meeting them for the CD? Mm-hmm. I figure they knew yours, but did you know theirs?
No, not so much, really. I didn't. I'd heard of Elvis Costello,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure I'd heard, you know, some of his recordings. But when I met him there in the studio, I brought him my number one box set, the Bear Family Records out of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Has put out two box sets on me, and everything that I recorded from 54 to about 73, it's all in there. So I took Elvis the number one box set, and when I said I'd like for you to have this, he took one look and he said, "Oh, I already have that one, and I have the number, and I have the number two box set too." So I think when an artist goes out and pays their money to buy, especially the box sets, I figured he must really be a fan. I had been told that he was. And we just had no problem singing together. I'd given him a choice of two or three different duets that I thought might be good, and he chose the one that I really liked the best, Crying Time. And even though our voices blended nicely, I thought, and we sang in the right keys where I could harmonize and then he could harmonize, and it was just a real nice experience.
I want to ask you about something else in your life that I'm sure was a very pivotal experience, a turning point. In 1971, you were born again.
Uh-huh, right.
If it's not too personal, what happened to you then that was behind such a, you know, a life-changing experience?
Life-changing, right. Well, I had come to the point in my life where I was realizing that I had everything I'd ever dreamed of wanting. I had a wonderful career, a wonderful husband, two beautiful, healthy children, homes and cars and, you know, everything that I wanted, and yet I just wasn't happy. And my husband and I, we knew that our marriage was kind of getting in trouble. Our children were being reared by grandmas and governesses, and we knew that some changes needed to be made, but I was fearful of making changes, and I think he probably was too, because our whole lives were wrapped around my career and our traveling. And I was in this frame of mind and all, and my husband too, when we went to church. It was a church that I'd been a member of since I was a little girl, but church had never been important to me personally, you know, at that point. So, the congregation began to sing, "Pass Me Not, O Gentle Savior," at the end of the preacher's message, I just realized that God was saying to my heart, Wanda, walk with me. And I could just understand it all of a sudden in my spirit that that's what was missing in my life. That's what was wrong. And I turned to my husband and I said, honey, there's something I've got to do. And he knew what I meant, and he said, me too. So in our churches, we go forward publicly and pray and receive Christ. And so that's what we did. We took each other's hands and went down the aisle, and we gave our hearts and lives fully and once and for all to Jesus Christ.
So you've been singing a lot of spirituals since you were born again?
Yes, I've written some and sang a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. You're speaking to us now from Oklahoma City, which is where you were born, but your parents moved when you were a girl to Bakersfield, California. Do you still have family in Oklahoma City? Is that where you live now?
Yes, I've made it my home, all except for the about 4 years that my folks lived in California. I was a little girl.
I see.
And so I met my husband here, and his folks were here. And with our traveling after we had children, it didn't make sense for us to move to Nashville or Hollywood or something, because with us gone so much, we wanted both sets of parents to be able to drop in and make sure our kids were being taken care of properly. So that was the main reason that we didn't move.
Now, what did your father do for a living when you were growing up?
He was a barber for a while, and he drove a cab. And that he was driving a cab when he quit that to travel with me.
Because you were underage when you started performing. You weren't 18 yet, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. What was it like being tutored by Elvis and how to play this kind of like sexy, rebellious music when you're traveling with your father?
Well, I don't know. I don't know as I thought of it like that. But my dad really liked Elvis. He was a big cut-up, and Elvis was too. And so they kept something going all the time, laughing and various things. And so it worked fine. Now, my dad went along to help me with driving and things like that. But he also, it was very important that my reputation stay intact. And I'm sure that was probably the main reason that he traveled with me. So I wasn't able to ever go from city to city in the car with Elvis, or I had to, you know, Dad had to drive me. I had to be in my car. And, you know, he didn't allow me to sit on someone's lap, and I couldn't lay my head on someone's shoulder if I was sleepy and they were riding with us, you know, and he was pretty strict in those things. But it did keep my reputation intact.
And there you are singing about like broken hearts and let's have a party and riot in cell block number 9.
Yeah.
With a dad making
strange.
Sure that your head isn't on anybody's shoulder. I love that.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's quite a contrast, isn't it?
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And I've enjoyed all of your questions.
And I, you know, congratulations on your new CD.
Thank you so much.
Wanda Jackson's new CD is called Heart Trouble. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Forster, starred in the now classic 1969 film Medium Cool as a TV news cameraman who remains detached from the cultural upheaval he is reporting. In 1972, Forster starred in the TV series Banyan, but his career never took off. He worked, but many of his roles were in movies like Kinky Coaches and the Pom-Pom Pussycats and Maniac Cop 3, Badge of Honor. But even if casting directors didn't notice his talents, Quentin Tarantino did. He cast Foster in the role of the bail bondsman in the 1997 film Jackie Brown, and that turned things around for Forster. He's since been in Me, Myself, and Irene, Like Mike, Lake Boat, Charlie's Angels Full Throttle, and Mulholland Drive. And now Forster is starring in the ABC series Karen Sisko, adapted from the film Out of Sight, based on characters created by Elmore Leonard. Carla Gugino plays an attractive U.S. Marshal whose dangerous work is always coming into conflict with her personal life. Forster plays her father, a semi-retired private eye. In this scene, they're on the phone together.
Hi, Daddy.
Listen to this. Guy goes in to rob a bank, tells his partner to circle a block. He comes running out, gets hit by a car. Who do you think's driving?
The partner.
Oh, they say irony's dead.
You working today?
Yeah, guy in a wheelchair. Insurance scam.
How'd he get in the chair?
Fell off his desk.
Well, they'll do that on you.
Every damn time. So, this new guy you're seeing, tell him what you do yet?
He still wants to guess.
Sounds like an insurance agent.
Charter fisherman. He owns a boat.
What's his name?
Carl Wilkins.
I always wanted a boat.
Dad, you get seasick.
What's that got to do with the price of eggs? Live by the ocean? Ought to have a boat.
I gotta run.
Why, you got something to do?
Yeah, I'm back at work.
How you feeling?
Not you too.
I'll see you tomorrow night at poker.
Bye, Daddy.
Bye, honey.
Forster has played a lot of cops and private eyes over the years. I asked him if there's anything in those roles that connect with his real personality.
Probably, you know, these guys are straight shooters, no nonsense, if not cynical, at least skeptical, and, you know, you can't put a lot by them. They've seen a lot, and so I take the mantle of that and pretend it's me.
Do you feel like you're that kind of person yourself?
Hardly. you know, I don't know much. My experience is limited by, you know, most human limitations. An actor, you know, actors do things that are, you know, sort of artificial. Notwithstanding, I've read a bunch of stuff of this genre, and so you pick up here and there, and you know, you pretend it's you.
How did you get the part in Karen Sisko?
I was doing pictures. Now, you know, I had a 5-year first act to my career, which ascended, and then a 28-year descending second act to my career, until Quentin Tarantino handed me Jackie Brown. And that, of course, put me back in business. And from that point, I was doing pictures, which was, you know, which is the big banana of this business, doing movies. While I was doing movies, I had my agent every once in a while would say, you know, there's a television series around the bend somewhere for you. And I'd say, you know, wait till I fail with pictures and let me cool off and eventually we'll do television. But earlier this year, a guy, John McNamara, who was the producer and writer of a show called Fastlane, wrote one for me. I played the father of Peter Facinelli, a guy who I'd worked with on Supernova a few years ago. And what a great part. This was a great character. And I did one episode, and then he wrote a second episode for me. And while we were shooting the second episode, I was on a hillside overlooking Los Angeles. We were standing by a pool waiting for the shot to get set up. And I thought, if I could find a character this good, I would do a television show, because you realize that if you're doing a movie, 10 weeks later, you're done with that character. Television show, if it's a good one, it can last a long time and you can be doing a great character for a long time. This is it. Now, the minute I said that, apparently he went into motion, and not too long after that, I received this script for Karen Sisko. And I have found the best thing I have. Listen, I've been waiting 40 years for this, and here it is. It's a great character with humor, and I just bring myself to the set. I don't have to do anything more than that. They write great stuff for me.
You had been the star of a TV series before Banyan.
Two series. One was called Banyan, a 30s detective. Old cars, old clothes, old jokes. Fast women, they all lie to me. That's what they do in the detective movies. And another television show 2 years later in 1974 called Nakia, a good guy Indian, deputy sheriff, New Mexico, contemporary, cops and robbers in the desert.
Did you like doing either of those?
I did, but I can tell you one thing. It's the hardest job I ever did. I've been an iron worker, and I was worked on the railroad. I was a substitute teacher, but nothing is as hard as carrying a television show. And Carla Gugino, who is the star of Karen Sisko, is the hardest working woman I have ever seen, met. She does short days are 12 hours. Her usual day is probably 13, 15 hours. And I have never heard her complain. She is not delicate. She slugs it out every single day. All I can tell you is that my experience doing my television shows is both of them got canceled half season, and I was relieved. I thought, oh, God, how can I get up another day and face the grind of a television show? So she is champion.
Now, it was Jackie Brown that really revived your career, the Quentin Tarantino movie. It's really a wonderful film, and I should mention it's out on DVD, too. Had you seen Quentin Tarantino's earlier films? I know he'd seen your work, and that's why he wrote the part of the bail bondsman for you, but had you seen his work?
Sure. Strangely, when my career was at its lowest, and I had been doing, you know, dopey exploitation movies for a few different guys who'd hire me. Bill Lustig was one of them, and Fred Williamson was another, and they made, you know, low-budget movies, cop sort of, or horror or whatever. And Lustig called me up one day and said, you know, I just bought a really great script from a guy you never heard of. His name is Quentin Tarantino. And this guy Tarantino claims there's a part in this script that Lustig, he said, was supposed to give to me. And I thought, oh boy, something to grab onto. My slide is over here. I'm going to get traction with this one. And I read it and it was great. And before the picture could get made, they grabbed it away from Lustig and gave it to a big director, Tony Scott, and he made True Romance out of it. And then I got a call from my agents.
So you didn't get the part in that after all?
No, I didn't even get close to it. This picture was made with real people, real stars. Then about a year later or so, my agent called me when I had one, who said, I've got there's a guy you're going to meet for a picture called Reservoir Dogs. You never heard of this guy, Quentin Tarantino. And they sent me the script, and I thought, oh boy, my slide is over. This thing is going to be good. This guy likes me. I'm going to get this part. And I went in there at Fox. I remember the reading, and I read this thing good. I knew what I was doing. And after I read it, I walked out of the room. He followed me out of the room, and he said, hey, listen. He said, you know, I've seen everything you ever did. And he started reeling off everything, and he'd seen everything, even the little picture I made, Hollywood Harry. And he said, but look, this thing is not going to work, he said, because I'm going to give this part to the guy that I dedicated the script to, Lawrence Tierney. So I didn't do that. Following that, he made Pulp Fiction and became a great big director. Years go by. I have breakfast at a place in Hollywood, West Hollywood, and I went into breakfast one morning. I'm sitting there, and in walks Quentin. And I call him over, and he comes over, and we blah, blah for a few minutes, and I ask him what he's doing, and he said he's adapting Rum Punch, an Elmore Leonard novel, to a movie. He said, why don't you read it? That was that. About 6 months later, I walk into the same restaurant. I turn the corner into the patio to look to go toward my own spot. Quentin's sitting in my seat. As I approach, he picks up a script. He hands it to me. He says, read this, see if you like it. Now, there has never been such a gift. He gave me a gift the size of which cannot be exaggerated.
Did you feel like you should be talking him out of it because you felt washed up? Do you know what I mean?
I didn't feel washed. No, I knew that if I hung in there long, and if I had a long, long shot strategy, and that was that someday some kid who liked me growing up would turn into a movie maker and give me a good part.
Oh.
How do you like that?
It worked.
It worked.
My guest is Robert Forster. He's co-starring in the ABC series Karen Sisko. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.